thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
Hi there.
Here's John Williams.
Thought a big one yesterday, but didn't get a chance to share it. It's 109. Actually, I did with my wife and two dogs. They weren't as impressed as I'd hoped. This is John Williams. We're in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue here until 3. Thanks for tuning in. Remember, you can always follow me on the Twitter. I'm WGN King John. There, that's King John, not Kim Jong. Those are different things. It's 110 now on WGN Radio. In a few minutes, Sam Panionovich says hi. We need to catch up on one little big sports story. And then we'll visit with Joe Orsolini, who's been on with us before. He's very good at helping you save money for college for your kids. Before we get done, let's talk about the removal of the homeless from the underpasses along Lakeshore Drive 2. The president spoke today before the United Nations. By the way, it was a not short speech, but it was by no stretch the longest. Fidel Castro addressed the UN General Assembly once upon a time and said, "Don't worry, I know I have a reputation for going long, but we've boiled this down to just the most important things, and it will not be a long speech." And then he spoke for 4.5 hours. Shortest speech was 1 minute. Somewhere in between was President Trump today. And, you know, he's getting some action for it was a nicely read speech. Every now and then he had his own flourishes, and those are the things that tend to get our attention but maybe shouldn't. He said parts of the world are going to hell. He said if the righteous many do not confront the wicked few, then evil will triumph. Some people thought that was ironic. But the thing that he said that is getting the most attention, of course, is this.
The United States has great strength and patience. But if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea. Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime. The United States is ready, willing, and able, but hopefully this will not be necessary. That's what the United Nations is all about. That's what the United Nations is for. Let's see how they do.
I'm not exactly sure what that last part is all about. I mean, I literally just don't know what he's saying. Let's see what they do. Is he saying, let's see what North Korea does or what the United Nations
does? No, he's challenging the UN, like, step up.
Let's see what you're going to do. And so then what are they going to do about it?
That's what the United Nations is for, to head off controversy or conflict like this.
Maybe they can do it. By the way, you know, since he launched the Fire and Fury tweet or statement, North Korea has fired missiles over Japan into their airspace. They've been doing everything to provoke trouble. And we haven't launched fire and fury on them, whatever that is. And thank goodness for that. None of us wants that. So I think when the president says that we're going to totally destroy them if we have to, then you need to take that with a grain of salt. In fact, I don't even think when he says totally destroy, this is me being sort of the armchair psychologist, interpreter, analyst here. He doesn't mean we're going to totally destroy. He doesn't mean that literally. He quite means that figuratively. Totally destroy is what happened to some of the small islands off the coast of Florida. They were totally destroyed. The verdant green hills now look like they had a forest fire. All of the leaves were ripped off the trees. That was total destruction. Total destruction would be nuclear war, or would be us coming in with tanks and killing Kim Jong-un and removing his government. Totally destroy them. And I don't think the president means either of those things. I don't think he means when he says, if we have to, we'll totally destroy them. I think that totally is to him just, it's an adverb. Let's see. Yeah, destroy describes a verb. I think it's just an adverb to him. He doesn't mean it literally. He means it rhetorically. Like, we're really going to mess with you. Don't you do that because I will really get in your kitchen. If he had said, if North Korea continues to develop nuclear weapons, we will totally get in their kitchen. We will really mess them up, man. That's what he was saying. He wasn't saying we're going to wipe them off the face of the earth. And I think you know that, and I think I know that. So when he says that, I think we don't need to strike any more fear into our own hearts than is already there. Your witness.
Completely disagree.
Thank you very much.
He meant destroy. First of all, your issue is not with totally, or it's with destroy. You're saying he's not really going to totally destroy. He's going to...
I am saying that.
Totally get in their kitchen.
Right. I wish he had said that. I'll totally get in their kitchen.
I don't think he has. He said the fire and fury, the likes of which the world has never known.
And we haven't launched any fire or fury.
Not yet.
In the time since he said that, though, they did everything that should have launched fire and fury. They continued to they detonated a hydrogen bomb, and we haven't done a damn thing about it. Nor should we right now. Really, what's the rush to nuclear war?
So, I agree, but I think his rhetoric was, "We will destroy you." His words were, "We will destroy you."
Well, words don't mean a lot to him.
You can make that argument, but I'm saying those were the words he used.
Okay, but I don't even know what "we will destroy you" means.
It means we will.
What does that mean? Tell me what happens when we destroy you.
It means
do we overthrow
total?
Your government, or does it mean we drop atom bombs on you? I don't know what that means, I don't know that he knows what that means either. And if he does, he's wise not to say it. Seriously, Steve, I'm not pestering you. I don't think he knows what it means. I don't think it has a specific definition. I don't think it means, and therefore, I don't think it means that much.
It implies that they will go in with full military force and remove UN and his regime.
More so than drop nuclear
bombs. And what
bombs,
happens with that is means, you know, that the North Korea likely would respond with attacks on South Korea miles away, and there would be, you know, incredible casualties.
And I don't think he is suggesting that. Or if he is, and I'm not a Donald Trump defender, but I try and keep both feet on earth because clearly he's not. So let's just all get a grip. That's my MO. I'm trying to just get a grip all of the time. I know it sounds either naive or Pollyanna-ish or inconsistent, but good grief.
Didn't Khrushchev pound his shoe at the UN and say, "We will destroy you"?
I don't know that that's an exact quote, but he did the shoe pounding.
I know. I
don't
just thought of
it.
Now, I think it might have been, "We will destroy you."
Elif, look up Khrushchev. K-R-U-S-K-E-F.
Shoe. And in his, in that rhetorical sort of period, I think it was more like, "We will eliminate you as a world force."
Oh, really? As opposed to
nuclear
weapons? Well, see, shame on you. Well, so now you appreciate the quandary that I'm trying to illuminate, that it's not really clear what it means, and where we are all assuming the worst and thinking that's overreach or scary. I think you're the one that's always telling me these, you know, Trump is not to be taken literally.
Trump doesn't take himself literally. We probably shouldn't take him literally, but he literally said, "We will destroy you."
Okay. Well, all right, fine.
Does that make sense?
Can
I live on that argument?
Sure you can, okay. But I don't think it's as powerful as you think it is. Okay, so then he says, and then he calls Kim Jong-un Rocket Man for reasons that are not clear to me either, except this. He thinks if you belittle somebody, then they become littler. That's a way to mock them, to just flick them to the side. Get away, Rocket Man. Ha, 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 ha. And the first analysis I saw on CBS this morning when I was listening and watching to the speech was John Dickerson saying that in fact completely validates that moniker is something that Kim Jong-un would be proud of. Oh, I'm Rocket Man. Yes, I'm known for the rockets. I'm known for fighting for my country. And by golly, we've got rockets now. I'm Rocket Man. You could see him singing an Elton John song on national television later today.
Better than, what was that other Korean, the Korean song? Ganga.
Gangnam Style?
Gangnam Style, yeah.
Thank you, Steve, for that observation.
Really, that didn't help at all.
Okay, so that's where
I go back, though, to what you just said about you thought he was belittling him and that would, you know, hurt him and things
like
that?
Well, I think that's his.
So when you say that, I think of Donald Trump at the correspondence of the Gridiron Dinner when President Trump ridiculed and belittled him, right? And they say that started the presidential campaign. So in a way, he was throwing his own dart. He's throwing a dart that is most effective against him. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, right. I mean, if in fact that's the case, then it could backfire. Rather than Kim Jong-un cowering away, going, "Oh, the world's most powerful nation just called me Little Rocket Man." I don't know what he's supposed to do with that, but it might embolden him, too, saying, "You want to see some rockets? Watch this. Watch this." So maybe it's not such a good strategy. I think some people just like the chest pounding. They like to see our president bray a little bit like that. I'm not so sure. I don't know if it's effective or not. I really don't care. I just think it looks positively juvenile. I think name calling at the UN, one nation to another, name calling at the UN by the President of the United States just looks positively adolescent. That's all I got from that. It's a 119. This is WGN. Dave, you're on WGN Radio. Hi, Dave. What can I do for you?
Hey, I was listening to the remarks that came in on text, and I agree totally with what they're saying. The man is vindictive, totally vindictive. He has made so many cast-out remarks that anybody that crosses him, they're going to be ruined.
Yeah.
Financially, any way, shape, or form, he will make it a point that he will go to the ends of his earth to make sure that they are totally destroyed and totally gone off the face of the earth.
Says Dave, take him literally. Dave, thank you. I'm going to go from you to Mary. What did you want to say, Mary? You're on WGN.
I don't think it's so much what we think. I think it's what Kim Jong-un thinks. If he gets kicked off enough by Trump's comments,
yeah,
he could launch and blow up the West Coast.
I think that's an interesting point. It's not what we think. It's not what the president meant. It's how does the world receive it? And that's the only one that matters. That's the only answer that maybe counts or counts the most. Well put, Mary. And finally, Scooter, jump in here. You're on WGN on line four. You are. Hold on, Scooter. Scooter, jump in there. What did you want to say?
Yeah, John, I was just listening to Donald Trump, and he sounded very presidential to me and as a leader of our country and defending our country and standing up for our country. And I just thought he made a good point to North Korea and the other our allies and stuff. And I thought it was a very good speech. I don't know what your opinion was, but I thought he's very presidential, and he showed his leadership at the UN today at his speech.
I'm really glad you're listening and called. Thank you, Scooter. It's 125. Excuse me. I'm fighting a little bit of a cold, and I don't mean to share that with you. Sam Panionovich has walked into our studio. Hi, Sam. How are you?
Hey, John. I'm good.
You are Mr. Sports here at WGN Radio, or part of our sports team. And Elif just handed me the shoe banging incident, but I'm looking for the line. What literally did he say? I will get that verbiage. I'm kind of interested in that. So on Saturdays, you and I worked together, met your dad at the Blackhawks training camp festival, and mom, what a delightful couple they are. I see where you get your charm and good looks because they're both of those things.
Thank you.
They also brought us coffee cake and donuts.
They do that.
So you are picking on weekends, five NFL games. You and I are in a pool of sorts. Describe that pool for me.
Five games against the spread in Vegas, the Westgate Super Contest. We're playing with Team Odd Shark. And right now, after 3-1-1 in week one,
right,
we went 3-2 this past weekend.
Gee. I was hoping to go 5-0.
Oh, geez. Yeah, you know, so did I.
How many teams are in this thing?
2,700
across the country.
We are 206 out of 2,700.
All right, so we're in the top 10%, which
top
is
top 7%. We are 2.5 points behind the leader. Three teams have 9 points. We have 6.5. You get a point for every win, half point for a tie. So we're right there.
What are the games we got right?
We got the Bucks right.
Say that again.
We got the Bucks over the Bears, easy.
Yeah.
I said 30-0. It was 29-0 with a minute left. We were almost there.
My son said to me, Sam's really right about this one, isn't he? I said, I knew we were going to win, but I was holding out hope that we wouldn't be as craptastic as we turned out to be.
Mike Lennon is very craptastic. Bucks right, was Steelers
that one of
right.
Was that one of the most embarrassing NFL Bears games you can remember in a while?
Yes, because they were almost shut out. A couple years ago, Jimmy Clausen had a game when he started a quarterback in Seattle. I think they lost 30-0 in week three. That was bad, too.
But it wasn't just the score. It was the ineptitude. It was just doing some dumb stuff.
Four turnovers, lots of penalties, really dumb stuff. You're right.
Throwing into coverage that you had no business. Not only coverage,
triple coverage.
On a four, you know, or you could pick up 4 yards. Okay, so never mind all of that.
So Bucks right, Steelers right, Skins right.
Now you got to give me the game. Steelers was Pittsburgh Steelers.
They beat the Vikings.
Oh, yeah, that's right. You had that one.
I had the Skins over the Rams.
I liked the Vikings in that other game, and you didn't take my advice. And then you had the Redskins beating the Rams.
Right. We lost the Packers on Sunday night because they decided before the game to announce that two of their offensive linemen were not going to play, which is always a killer. I'm like, okay, well, what do you do there? And then the Seahawks had a tough time with the 49ers, so we didn't cover that one. But the Packers, I told you, 3-1 going into Sunday night. You think with Aaron Rodgers, you're in good hands. But two of his receivers were hurt. Two of his linemen before the game were scratched, so nothing you can do.
Right. You have any wisdom for us about the Cubs right now?
Cubs with 13 games left, they pretty much push the Cardinals out of the conversation, right?
That's getting, that's taking care of business. That's, you know, when Milwaukee and St. Louis come to town, that's what you got to do.
So 13 games left. They lead Milwaukee by 3.5. They have 4 games with the Brewers starting on Thursday, 4 in Milwaukee. And then a 6-game lead on the Cardinals, 3 games in St. Louis next week. As long as they don't get swept by Milwaukee, J-Dub, I think the division is theirs.
And over the weekend, we were reminded that the most fervent, loyal fan base in Chicago is the Chicago Blackhawks fans.
Preseason game number 1 tonight in Columbus. None of the heavy hitters will play. No Taves, no Kane.
Oh, really?
Yeah, none of the good players. More of a tryout for the bottom 6 forwards and a couple defensemen. But you should see the big guys on Thursday night at home. Hawks play the Red Wings in their home preseason opener. That'll be Thursday night. But you're right, Blackhawks Radio is back tonight.
Yeah, looking forward to that. 5:30 the pregame, 6 o'clock they'll drop it. Sam, nice to see you. Nice to hear you, my friend.
See you Saturday.
So Saturday, you and I will pick 5 more games, and let's see if we can get even higher than the top
7%. I'm sorry that 60% is not good enough for you. I'm very upset.
60%? What do you mean 60%?
3-2.
Oh, yeah.
You were like, woof.
Well, we're in the top 93%. That's still not good enough. We're
60%, that's a D, isn't it?
Thank you. We're either in the money or we're out of the money.
In Vegas, Steve, Vegas thinks 60% is an A+, just so you know.
Will we win any money if we finish in the top 7%?
No, we need to finish in the top 5%.
My point exactly.
I will be better.
Thank you, sir. This is John Williams. We're in the Allstate Showcase Studio here on Michigan Avenue. The sun is shining on the sidewalk just outside our window. There's some clouds overhead, but it's not such a bad day. What's current temperature again, Steve? What's the temperature at the airport or the lakefront?
76 degrees.
Yeah. If you'd like, a little later on, I'll triangulate some temperatures with you, and maybe after the 2 o'clock news, I can pick one of the cities in the area. I'm on a roll on that. You know?
I'm not sure I'm going to be here for the 2 o'clock news.
If you
news.
Could be here right after the 2 o'clock news, I'll go ahead and perform that.
We'll see how that works out.
Kind of magical feed for you.
Always fun.
Also, in the 2:30 segment, we'll visit with Sue Hendrickson. She is the, what do you call it, archaeologist? Paleontologist. The discovered Sue, the dinosaur that bears her name. No one's talked to her live on the radio or TV since it was announced that Sue will be exiting her prized position at the museum. So we'll catch up with Sue. We've been trying to ever since that announcement was made a couple of weeks ago. She's been out of country. We'll say hi to her in a little bit. It's 1:39. Right now we say hi to Joe Orsolini. Joe's been on this show before. He may have been in your living room. He's the president of College Aid Planners. He helps families plan for college and those expenses. Joe, welcome back to the studio.
Thanks for having me.
And I guess now is kind of an important time. We invited you to come back now because right now families are at least looking at schools, right?
Yes. Now is the time that the high school seniors are out picking colleges and looking at schools and getting their applications in for next fall.
So, yeah, but they're not thinking about paying for them right now. They're just picking their schools now.
Well, that's one of the problems, and that's why it's so important for parents to get involved with the whole which schools we're looking at. The financial aid system is going to turn on in October. That's when the financial aid system turns on. And schools will start handing their money out sometime in November or December. So if you're picking schools that aren't going to fit the family budget, if you're, you know, do the financial aid, it's like coming, it's not first come, first serve financial aid. It's like coming home to dinner late. So if they start handing that money out and you find out these schools aren't going to work for you, it's going to be too late to double back and pick some schools that are going to be more affordable. So you got to get it right.
So,
early on.
So would you say then the starting point is schools we think we can afford or schools we can get into or schools that we aspire to? I mean, how would you build that list?
You need to have – it's okay to have all of the above, but you certainly have to have schools that, one, you know, you can get into that are academic fits, and two, that are also financial fits. Nothing's worse than picking a whole bunch of schools that – you find out, hey, we're not going to be able to afford these schools. And the problem is, you know, you may not find this out the price-wise until sometime in March when the final award letters come out. And by then, it's too late. So then you're scrambling trying to figure something out, and that's, you know, you may get dumped into community college. Not just anything wrong with community college, but it blows up your plans.
Yeah, don't say dumped into community college. You're talking to a grad of Joliet Junior College. The Wolves did me right, I think. In fact, really, this is maybe no consolation to you if your heart is broke. But I got some of the best education of my life at Joliet Junior College.
Absolutely. There's nothing wrong
with... Those are college professors there. Yeah. Those are college students there. And the fact that it's a commuter college doesn't, I don't think, change the amount of learning you can do there.
No, absolutely not. Nothing wrong with the 2+2 option. You know, do the 2 years at community college, then move on to the 4-year school. Some of my best friends from college were done the 2+2 option. They're, you know, incredibly successful. It's you, not the school you attend, that makes you successful.
Well, but you want to go away to the fun school.
I get
you want to go to the U of somewhere or someplace that's a private school and it's on a leafy campus.
Yeah, you know, that's hey, I admit it. I'd love to go away to school. But the thing is, you want to make sure that you're doing what's going to be financially smart. Nothing's worse than, you know, going away to school for 4 years, and then you're in so much debt that you have to come back in, you know, 25, 26 and live in your basement again.
So what's the plan to save money or finance an education?
Well, the thing is, the key is to know what your family has available for college. I'm amazed that parents, even at this late stage in the game, that haven't sat down and figured out amongst themselves or even talked to the kids of, this is what we have available for college. I had a couple of meetings over the weekend. Parents, I said, what can you afford? They hadn't even had that discussion yet.
Well, should parents, if their kid is a senior or junior, I don't know, should they already have a little nest egg of money ready to go?
In an ideal world, yes. In reality, you know, that's not always the case. So if you don't have the money available, it's time to come up with, you know, another plan.
Well, but even if you do, I suppose most people are going to borrow some money, right?
Yes, certainly the kids are going to get their student loan. The federal government will lend you $27,000 over the course of 4 years. So that's, you know, one piece of it.
27 for 4 years. So
for 4 years. Over the course of 4 years. 5,500 freshman year, 65 sophomore, 75 junior and senior year. That's all that you can borrow in your name as a student without somebody co-signing for you.
From the federal government?
From the federal government.
Do you recommend people do that?
I have no problem with the federal student loans. You know, I think it's good that the kids have skin in the game. If the parents want to help them out down the line, you know, fantastic. You get a certain grade point average, you know, get out in 4 years.
$5,500 ain't going to get you through the U of I. So what else then? Where do I go for money after that?
Well, beyond that, there's also some tax credits that are available for families. Don't discount that. There's a $2,500 American Opportunity Credit that's going to be added back into the mix. And beyond that is what can the parents pay on a monthly basis. You're either going to money you've saved, money you earn and cash flow as you go along, or money you're willing to borrow.
Where should you borrow if you have to borrow more?
You know, the federal government will lend parents money through something called a PLUS loan. It's a federal parent loan program. You can also go to private student loans. And the way I really recommend for a lot of folks is home equity. You know, these days people have home equity, if they still have home equity available. That's really one of your best options, because if you're borrowing through a Parent PLUS loan or a private student loan, something bad happens in life, you know, you're out in the streets, and but you still have that student loan debt hanging over your head. Student loan debt never goes away. You can't get rid of it in bankruptcy. The thing with home equity is something bad happens. Yeah, nobody wants to put their home on the line, but if something bad happens, you get to walk away from that. That's all part of the bankruptcy proceeding. So, you know, from that standpoint, it's more flexible for families. And also the student loan interest is deductible on a home equity loan, using it to pay for student loans, versus the student loan, you're limited in the amount and also the you're based on your income.
I'm trying to think of what the interest rate consequences are. Say I'm paying 4% on my home loan. Some mm-hmm. people are, right? Maybe
yep.
4 or 5%.
Yep.
So now I'm going to keep paying on that loan 4 or 5%. That's probably a better rate, though, than I would get if I was borrowing.
The federal PLUS loan next year, PLUS loan program, is going to be 7%. 7% fixed.
Yeah.
On some of the private student loans, I've seen upwards. I had a few clients come through. They were, and one had a 12.85 interest rates.
Really?
On a fixed interest rate. Yeah. They were very expensive.
What
I
are
was
you
shocked.
Estimating the cost of college is right now?
When I'm working with families, my goal is to take a $40,000 to $60,000, actually $70,000 to $40,000 sticker price, get you somewhere in the mid to low 20s is really my goal in working with families.
I don't know what you mean by that.
$25,000 a year. That's where we're kind of targeting.
That's how much money I should be ready to have, $25,000 a year.
$25,000 a year out-of-pocket costs to the family.
And why did you just reference 40 to 70K?
40 to 70K is going to be the sticker price.
That's what they're going to charge. But then your kid got to be average, so we'll knock 10 off. And here's some loans and grants.
Exactly.
So schools do that all the time, and I don't exactly understand why. Then why do they call it a $60,000 a year room and board and tuition when really nobody pays that? Everybody's paying 42.
Well, it's at the private schools, nobody pays sticker price. State schools, a lot of times, state schools don't have as much merit money. Merit aid is we want your kid to come here, so we're going to knock something off the price. And the problem with the state schools is a lot of times kids want to go out of state. And they want to go to the flagship school, right? They want to go to Indiana University or Wisconsin-Madison. And those schools are, you know, $40,000, $50,000 a year, and you will pay sticker price for those schools.
Give me an example of a family that, I don't know, I hate to say this, maybe tell me one that did it right, but give me an example of somebody who did it wrong, too.
Well, one of my classic stories and really got me on the whole student loan debt kick was I had a young lady come into my office a couple years ago, and she came out of one of these elite colleges, $172,000 in debt for her undergrad. I didn't work with her going in. I got her coming out. But she also wanted to go to law school, put another $140,000 on top of that. Now, it took her a while to get into law school, and that was compounding in the background the whole time, piling on, piling on. So when she got done with law school, her student loan debt was, her payment was $65,000 a year. She had to pay $65,000 a year. Now, her goal in life was to be a prosecutor, work for the Cook County State's Attorney's Office. Well, the starting salary there was $59,000. So on day one, you know, when she hops out of bed and heads to the shower, she is $6,000 in the hole for the rest of that year and hasn't even been to lunch yet. You know, if this girl ever moves out of her parents' house or buys a car, it'll be a miracle. The one thing she's got going for her is if she does end up getting married, she'll know it's true love because no one's signing on board for $65,000 a year.
Oh, that's heartbreaking. That's a sad story.
And
evidently, they did a lot of things right. You're smart enough to go to law school. You said it was an elite school, an expensive one, so I presume it's one I would know. Shame on the schools, first of all, for even allowing that.
Well, you know, that's part of the problem is they will let you borrow whatever you want. The federal, the PLUS loan program has no income qualification. So mom and dad can go and borrow whatever they want. I had a young man in my office a few years ago. His mom made $13,000. He wanted to go be a fiction writer. So he, the federal government was going to lend his mom, who made $13,000, $22,000 a year to send him to college. I finally had to pull the kid in and say, do your mom a favor. Go sit at Starbucks for the next 4 years and write 35 books and be done with it.
We have some questions and some comments. You may be one of them. 312-981-7200. An observation, a question. We're talking about college-age financing because your kids are picking schools right now. They're driving. A friend of mine was just over the weekend, had a conversation with a friend, and they're looking at this school. What about that school? It is so much fun. You know, I mean, it's also terrifying. And it's obviously not for everybody, but if you're fortunate enough to sort of live through that little bit of a dream of where am I going to send my kid to school and what are their options and picking one out, it's challenging, it's frightening, it's soul-searching, and it's expensive. And right now is the time a lot of you are going through that little dance. 312-981-7200. You can call or text WGN. Got a text that poured in during the break from a friend who said, that's false when you said, John, that nobody pays retail at those small private schools. I don't even know if this person is referring to small private schools, but they said we paid full retail for college. It was a blessing and a curse. I guess the blessing part is they must have been able to do that.
Yeah.
Because most folks, I don't think, are so fortunate, and they get some sort of assistance. By the way, every year about this time, we also hear from people who are ticked at the University of Illinois because of their admissions policies. What are you hearing about that these days?
Well, yeah, I mean, the problem is U of I is a flagship school. So, you know, they're always going to get the cream of the crop students. They also have a mandate that they have to take students from every county in Illinois. So, you know, if you're from DuPage County or Lake County where there's a lot of good qualified students, you may get pushed out. You know, the other problem I kind of have on a personal basis with U of I is that it's hard to jump in between majors. If you don't get into the right college you want to get into, it's hard to move back and forth. There's a lot of competition down there.
What percentage of the students are from China that go to U of I?
I haven't seen this year's figures. I think it was pretty close to 10% last year. In fact, they were even doing the football games in Chinese. They had Chinese broadcasters.
You're kidding.
No.
Of course, those students pay, you talk about paying full freight, they pay a premium. I mean, that's a cash cow for the U of I.
And that's why, you know, schools like the foreign students, like out-of-state students, because they will be hit for full price. That's the problem with if you're from Illinois, when you go out-of-state to the flagship schools, you know, you're a cash cow to some other state's university system.
Joe Orsolino, because we don't have reciprocity in Illinois with many of these other states.
Actually, we in the last few years have gotten it. There's something called the Midwest Student Exchange Program, and it's a number of schools that have agreed, schools here in the Midwest that have agreed to play nice with each other.
Do we have it in Wisconsin and Iowa for Illinois?
It's Michigan, Indiana, Wisconsin, Illinois, Minnesota.
Really?
Jumps over Iowa, Missouri, Kansas, and North Dakota.
Reciprocity with Illinois.
Well, the deal is if you go to one of these out-of-state schools and you get in the program, you end up paying roughly 150% of the in-state tuition rate. So it's not full reciprocity, but it's a great deal. It's more typically your second-tier schools in these states, not second class, but second tier, like the Northern, sure. Southern, Eastern, Westerns. But there's some great values there. If you want to be in the mid-20s, that's one of the ways to do it.
Okay, but 150 is not 100%. It's not 50, it's not even.
Correct.
Lots of phone calls for Joe Orsolini. He is the president of College Aid Planners. Let's pick up a phone line. We'll start with Maurice. You're on WGN. Hi, Maurice. How can we help you?
Hi, guys. Listen, I had a quick question about your college savings there. My wife and I, we hold decent-paying jobs. I work for the federal government, and she works for the city. And I think it's kind of late in the game to be saving money for college. My kid's 13 years old, and, well, she's in eighth grade. Next year, she'll be going to high school. So she has, my wife has this crazy idea that she's going to use her deferred comp to help pay for college. Now, deferred comp is a kind of supplemental type retirement fund there for city employees. I have something equivalent to that, which is called a thrift savings plan, which I get matching dollars for that. So I just want to know, do you think that's a good idea to start tapping into your retirement savings to pay for some of the college? And if you know of anybody that's done that before, I just don't think it's a smart thing, because when you're in retirement, man, look, you need every dime. You need every dime that you can muster. The insurance costs are very expensive when you retire. You just really need to watch your money. And I think paying for college education out of the retirement system is probably not a good thing. So I just want to hear your thoughts about that.
Yeah, as a general rule, I'd say yes. You don't want to be tapping retirement to pay for college or jeopardizing your retirement. You know, as an adult, you have to do three things. Save for retirement, save for your kids' college, and pay your house off. Ideally, you're doing two of those three things pretty steadily. Now, do I have clients that have, hey, we've saved a ton of money for retirement, and we're now, you know, we're in our late 40s, early 50s, and going to stop and divert that money to pay for college? Sure, but you want to make sure that you've got your retirement set up.
That's not what he's asking you, though. He's got money.
I guess to answer that, to your specific point, you know, it's okay to tap retirement if you think you have enough there already. You know, if you're concerned, hey, we're not going to have enough, or, you know, we can't live on what we have saved, then you need to be taking a look at doing something different rather than tapping the retirement.
Right. Do you think at this stage of the game, it's probably a little bit too late to start doing that?
Eighth grader.
Seeing that she has about four more years to go.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Start saving now. I mean, if nothing else, you're going to get used to writing that check. You know, if you've got a kid going to the state school, Illinois State next year, you're writing about a $1,400, $1,500 month check when they get there. So get used to writing that check now. So maybe you're putting away $700, you know, half of that cost. Get used to writing that check now, because it's a lot easier to go from, you know, $700 to $1,400 than it is straight to the $1,400. You know, it's like running a marathon. You don't go run the 26.2 right out of the box.
And your point has always been, and start to adjust your your schools. If that's the money math for you, now get the school that matches the money.
Absolutely.
Joe, I'm out of time. Maybe you come by on my Saturday show sometime
soon. Happy to do so.
All of our phone lines are ringing. How can folks reach you if they want to?
Best thing is go to my website, www.collegeaidplanners.com.
CollegeAidPlanners.com. Joe Orsolini, thanks for coming by.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have
to. There was one.
Here's John Williams.
Hi. It's 2:10. We're in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. Always appreciate you joining us. You can call or text anytime you like. We're here all the way until 3. Then Roe and Anna will continue to do what they do, and they do it well. Mama 1, Anna 2. Took yesterday off, had a 3-day weekend. I very much enjoyed that. Not only did I not have to think big thoughts, but I was able to do some things around the house and town and stuff like that that I was kind of meaning to do, so we got some things done. I was able to watch the Emmys. I was surprised at the backlash to the Emmys and Sean Spicer for his cameo.
Were you?
Surprised, yeah. I mean, I thought it was funny and hilarious. It was short. It was a one-off. And then they wheeled him away. People were mad at the Emmys for helping him repair himself. And people were mad at him for trivializing his previous role. I think in each case, it's good that we all get along. What's the point of continuing to vilify poor little Sean Spicer? Of course, this goes back to my theory all along that if you are mad at Rex Tillerson and Mike Pence and Sean Spicer and Reince Priebus or Paul Manafort. Don't put Manafort in there. But all of these people who have been working, Kellyanne Conway, for the president, I think you need to be very cautious about that. Because the job, say, of a Sean Spicer was to articulate the views and feelings of the leader of the free world.
Yeah, but it's an interesting thing because had he not been made fun of by Melissa McCarthy, I mean, you're right, and he was doing his job. And
the guys, and so what you saw coming out of Sean Spicer's mouth was the stuff that Trump said, you get in and you do it. He was reflecting, and if Spicer was softer, kinder, more deferential, they would have fired him and got somebody else to do it.
And so you can't. Right. I mean, all of that is true, but he also did it. I mean, let's take the worst case scenario. Let's say he went out there and knowingly lied to the American people several times.
Okay.
Okay, let's say he did that. It was his job. He was bullied into doing it, and yet he did it. So while you can have sympathy for his position, I don't know that you need to embrace him for having done it.
So
I'm Mr. Sympathetic. So, you know, it didn't occur to me right away until I thought about it a little more. I'm not sure what the right course there. You know what I'm saying?
Because you can say if you're the Sean Spicer, say, okay, well, I in good conscience can't do this. Fine, we'll find somebody with a bad conscience to do it.
Right.
Now, how are we served?
Well,
if all of the good people don't serve the nutty president, then we're really screwed.
Or you can say, look, I know he was doing his job, and I know he lied to us. He was forced to do it. I'm sympathetic and understanding of that, but I'm not going to let him come on and help repair his image on my show.
Yeah, so then that was the other question then. So now what do we do? Do we let him come on? And
I thought it was funny.
Are we laughing with him? Are we laughing at him? The funny thing is he seems utterly likable. If you saw him on, what was it? Was it Jimmy Kimmel that he came on? No. It was... whose talk show did he come on? Kind of broke the...
I thought it was Jimmy Kimmel.
Was it Jimmy Kimmel or was it Colbert?
Cole Kimmel.
We also are enjoying watching the Vietnam series by Ken Burns. Are you looking at that yet?
No.
It's okay. I mean, I understand the frustration with the enormity of what you have before you.
Well, but I was thinking of that this morning, John, because last night I was trolling for a new show to watch.
It was Jimmy Kimmel, by the way. Keep going, Steve.
I was trolling for a new show to watch and, you know... I want to find a series of 12 episodes or something. That's 12 hours. So why would you be afraid to watch 18 hours of the Vietnam War?
90 minutes at a crack.
Oh, that's too much.
So you are sitting here today, you're already behind 3 hours.
Yeah.
And it's three. The first episode, however good, was laborious. I mean, it was fascinating, but you had to pay attention because they told the story from the turn of the last century, how we got into Vietnam. We're talking about a lot of conversation about the French and the Chinese. You need to, if you want to know why we fought the Viet Cong, then you need to know why the French and the Chinese were fighting over that land too. And it goes back way before World War II. And if you don't want to study that, then that wasn't the episode for you. To be honest with you, I thought it was going to be a little more riveting, however comprehensive it was. And you got the feeling that every now and then they cut then from that to what it led to. And then there's some soldiers walking through muddy rice fields, you know, in 1967. And then you kind of lean into that. But then they pull back and tell you more of the history. But again, it's 18 hours, so we got time. That's at least what the first episode was like. I'm behind on the second one already. It's Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. I think they take Friday and Saturday off and then come back with the rest of it. So hang in there, Steve. You're going to have to watch it. The problem is now you've got to figure out how much your DVR can handle. Because the other night, I wanted to watch Monday Night Football or Sunday Night Football. But then I also had Outlander to watch.
Watch Outlander?
Oh, my God, has that a great show.
Oh, really?
And you got Dancing with the Stars is back. And you've got, what else? And Ken Burns.
Is Outlander, like, overly romantic?
Yes, but my wife loves it, and so I sit on the sofa with her.
Because I was thinking that, you know, because I've taken groups to Scotland, and we go to Outlander sites. And I've interviewed the author, Diana Gabaldon, I think.
No kidding, really?
Yeah, a long time ago. And so I looked at that one, too, but it looks like such a soap opera.
It's a little bit of that, but it's great history, I think. To be honest with you, I'm pretty sure that in 16th century Scotland, they weren't time traveling back to a nurse in 1948. So there's that. But if you can just get over the time leap stuff, they're really well-told dramas. It's great writing, great acting. And I'm not sure how much history I'm going to take away from this thing. But Outlander is beautiful people, by the way. And boy, when they get it on, they get it.
There's a lot of nudiness.
They get it right. It is there's just some reading about the show, and suddenly I found myself on a website that was top 15 nude TV shows.
Mm.
So I'm like, well, I'll have some of that. So I click through there, and there's Game of Thrones and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But Outlander is on there as well. But it's done in an artful way, and I feel like it's appropriate that we see it. Abraham Lincoln's leaving or is gone. Abraham Lincoln and Sweater Man have left Chicago.
Where's the Sweater Man?
He is not here. If they were right, they'd use him as a flotation device in Lake Michigan and just send Lincoln to Peoria, but they're on their way to Peoria. I warned a friend about that. He said, yeah, we're real excited. I said, well, don't be too excited, because I know you're anxious to see Lincoln, but wait till you see the doofy standing next to
him. Wouldn't it be funny if they put Sweater Man in about 18 feet of water in Lake Michigan?
Oh, that would be kind of like a... you know, Planet of the Apes sort of thing. You could just see the head and the arms coming up over 18 feet of water in Lake Michigan. That'd be kind of fun.
Could be a new Cardigan Reef.
Really, you could swim out to and use him as a, you know, like a raft or something.
I'm exhausted, man. I swam to Sweater Man today.
And back. All right, maybe it's not that funny. All right, I need to change tone and topics. I want to talk to you just a little bit about what's going on under the viaduct on Lakeshore Drive. You and I have discussed this, Steve Bertrand. This is John Williams. You're listening to WGN Radio. I'll pick up a couple of your phone lines about all of this nonsense in a second. But after the break, I want to get to what's happening with the homeless that live under Lakeshore Drive and the viaducts, specifically two streets. And they've cleared out the 10 cities that have popped up there. We're talking about just a few dozen people. But we really are talking about much more than that. And I have from day one been on the side that those people don't own that space. It's not their place to live. I don't think I'm doing a good enough job articulating the fact that I'm sensitive to their situation, and we need to try and accommodate them to some degree. But here's something else that's frustrating me about this story. I have 2 points to make. One is they don't get to live there. They have no right there. I don't believe in squatters' rights on limited public places like that, particularly when it's an access area to get from one side of the highway to the other to the lake. I have no sympathy for their expectation to live there. But I also think this. So if we kick them out of there, where are they going to go? I think they need to own that problem more than I'm reading they are. I know these are people with drug or alcohol problems or mental health issues or some sort of chronic life issues that I'm fortunate enough to not have to deal with. But if they're clever enough to figure out how to live in a tent under the highway, then they ought to invest that much energy into finding other means to take care of themselves. And if they can't, then, I don't know, find the Salvation Army or find some sort of city place that will take them in. We have thousands of homeless in this city, and 25 of them or 30 of them should not be clogging up the underpass. And I have no sympathy for their right to that place, though I'm sympathetic to their plight generally. So that's where I am on this one. I'll take your call next. We arrived at Tribune Tower on Monday morning to a sight that made us rejoice. A giant crane had lassoed the Lincoln statue in Pioneer Court. Moving day. No more 31-foot-tall, 19-ton tribute to America's greatest president and some dweeb in khakis and sneakers who wandered in off the street. No more tourists strolling by, peering at the statue and muttering, what's up with that? I kind of agree. But that was the president to every man with the Emancipation Proclamation, explaining it and showing the way to the people. He's showing him the way to Peoria now. Ron, you're on WGN. This is John. What can I do for you?
Hello, John. Hey. I'm a Vietnam veteran. I'm watching the PBS special. I'm getting some facts that I didn't know about it. But I'm also seeing errors. But I just read the opening statement that Ken Burns did. He said something to the effect, I don't have in front of me, that our leaders who took us into Vietnam for whatever their intentions had nothing but good, honorable, and which is total garbage. I mean, if you're watching from the beginning, You saw what we took over. We took over a colonial empire, and we tried to incorporate it in our own. And here, I'll give you the first episode when you mentioned it is glaring. They said Eisenhower didn't want to let the vote go forward because he said Ho Chi Minh would win. He didn't say 80% of the vote that he would win. Just, and then this, the last episode, they said the Saigon generals, our side, decided to assassinate Diem. Nothing was done there without the CIA's orders. Plain and simple. We paid for it, and everything under that was done under our rule. So these omissions are glaring because we're getting ready to go into another land war with Asia. And if we're not going to tell the truth with what this past debacle that we went through, what can we expect? And then we have a leader in our country and the other country that are both unhinged.
Yeah, I know. They're taunting each other from across the Atlantic or Pacific, across the other sides of the world. You know, it's funny because I know the very sentences you're talking about, because it's when he decided to use the word fail instead of lose. And then he did talk about the honorable intentions of the United States that got us into the Vietnam War. And I thought, I know how carefully crafted that language was because we talked about it. And I've watched that part of the show three times now. So when I saw it on TV, it resonated with me just a little bit. I was really thinking about what they chose to say there. I'm going to do this, Ron. I'm going to play back the opening sentences of the series from episode one tomorrow. Come here between 2 and 2:30 tomorrow. I'm going to play that because it does set the sort of template for the rest of the show. And you either accept it or you don't. But I think you've touched on something there, and I really appreciate your call. And don't beat yourself up about every detail, every fact, every nuance that they get wrong. In some ways, I think the truth is not knowable about some of these things. And I think from what I've seen, the research is amazing. But we'll come back to this tomorrow, Ron. And if you want to check in then, I'd appreciate it, okay?
I'll do my very best, John, and thank you very much for engaging this important conversation.
Amen to that, my friend. Thanks for the call. Yeah. Now, you got to watch this, Steve. Steve's still busy over there in the newsroom. Can you watch it on the train? That'd be great if you could watch it on your device.
Yeah, I'm sure. Why couldn't you? I mean, I drive.
Oh, never mind that then. Yeah, don't do that. Steve, I don't want you watching it on the way to work. Don't do that. Dave, this is John. What did you want to say? You're on WGN Radio. Hi, Dave.
Hey, John. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I lived downtown for years in the 90s and early 2000s, and now I go down a few times a year for work and other stuff. And I was literally just down there today in the near west side and the near north side, and it is unbelievable the amount of homeless people everywhere, camped out everywhere. And it's kind of like the boiled frog thing. You turn up the temperature and you don't notice it, but when you don't go down there as much, and I think the city has just ignored this, it was shocking to me how many everywhere there were.
Do you have any suggestions? What are we going to do with those people, Dave?
You know, I don't know, but there's other cities that have dealt with this, and Indianapolis is a great situation. 15 years ago, there was a huge, huge homeless problem. And then now you go down there, and there's a few, but there's not many. Now, does it mean they just, I don't know what they did, whether they opened more shelters or created more facilities or what have you, but I agree. It almost feels like they need to reach out to another city that has dealt with this and find out a good solution for everyone.
I don't know.
It doesn't mean it's kicking them out, but.
No, I get it.
I don't know if the numbers are different, but to me, it's that they did in the past. You wouldn't allow tents. You wouldn't allow tent cities, and that's what struck me. Just north of Tribune Tower, underneath, there were several tents, and I think that's the change.
Well, if they're comfortable living in those tents, and the tents are nice, I wonder if we could
division off ramp off the highway underneath.
I'm just wondering if what if we found a public space where they could camp, where this would be the place to go set up your tent and live? And that sounds horrible, doesn't it? But, they got to live in a tent somewhere.
There's enough TIF money out there. They could do something with it.
Yeah, John, I appreciate your phone call. Thanks for joining us, 2:30. Sue Hendrickson, who discovered Sue the dinosaur, you know, the one at the Field Museum, says hello to us. We got some catching up to do. That's coming up here on WGN. So you heard a couple of weeks ago that Sue the famous dinosaur is going to be still housed at the Field Museum but moved to a less prominent place. And a lot of us said, no, wait. And then you find out that the dinosaur that's going to replace her isn't even a carnivore. And you think, oh, you've got to be kidding me. I think I'm not alone in saying I've grown fond of Sue, even if I don't go there all the time. It's the very notion that Sue is there. It's kind of one of those iconic Chicago things. And props to Sue, because it didn't take very long for all of that to happen. Sue Hendrickson is on a phone line. Hey, Sue, it's John Williams. You're on WGN Radio. How are you?
I'm fine.
The Field.
Wish I was in Chicago with you.
Where are you right now, Sue?
Oh, I'm in Seattle. I'm on my way to go out looking for bones for a short few days.
So you are a field paleontologist and still doing that work then, huh?
I do. I don't get to do it very often or for very long because I'm busy on lots of other things, but it's still one of my primary loves is to go out in the field and look.
Well, you know, lucky
so
you.
I've been lucky.
Well, you know, I was wondering about that. So I thought, like, if you are the person who discovers a famous dinosaur, do you almost feel like somebody who's won the lottery, there's no sense playing anymore because what are the chances I'll find another great big one like that?
Oh, I'm sure I will never find another great, great dinosaur or T-Rex ever. And I still don't believe I ever did because it just doesn't happen like that. But it does not stop me wanting to go and look. The joy of looking and the peace of being out there is what has always drawn me and still does. But you don't go out with great expectations, and I still don't go out with great expectations. How it happened to me that one time is still unbelievable to me and everybody who worked on her. It's just... she's too superlative, and how could it happen, and how could it happen to me if it did happen? But it did.
So Sue is named after you?
Yes, against my wishes.
And when you were, I'll ask you about that in a moment, but you've described for us before, you've talked to actually me on this radio station years ago, I'm sure you've long forgotten, exactly that moment of discovery. Can you just recount a little bit of that, Sue?
It was extremely strange. You know, we'd been looking at a number of areas around a ranch where the Black Hills Institute had worked for many years. And we covered 6 exposures on one side of the area and considered it done. And there was nothing at all in those exposures. And a few days later, from across, you know, a few miles away, looking back, I could see there was one little place that had been around a corner and not visible from over there. And I thought, oh, we didn't look at that. I should go look there. And it was just in the back of my mind for a couple weeks. We had found some partial Triceratops skulls, and we're collecting those, and we were nearly finished. We were on our second to last day, and we got up in camp and had a flat tire and the spare was low. And I said, perfect. All the rest of the team had already left. There were still 2 adults and myself and 2 kids. And I said, great, you don't need me. You guys go fix the tire because we're 30 miles from a town. So, like, you know, it would take them a while. I said, there's this one little place I wanted to look, and this gives me the time window to do it. So I went over there, and anybody who was familiar with looking for bones versus rocks would have seen her. She wasn't hard to see. You just had to be there. Again, this is pretty remote, way out of towns and, you know, remote ranches, and one little place we missed, and there she was. And it made no sense. The other exposures had no significant bones. There were scraps, but even insignificant scraps. So there was nothing to logically make me think there'd something great would be there.
Yeah.
But there she was. It was me and my dog.
So how do you feel about Sue being moved from the, you know, the grand entry of the museum to another room on the second floor?
I'm actually ecstatic about it. way back when they first obtained Sue and were preparing her and trying to decide where to put her, back then it was discussed, well, let's make her own room, her own display area. But then due to time constraints and, you know, many, what do we do this or do we do that? They went for Stanley Field Hall, which it's a wonderfully impressive big hall, but it actually diminishes Sue. She's very pleased, and I'm very pleased that, that she'll be moving. She'll be shown as more impressive. I mean, she really is impressive. She's really amazing. She is the largest carnivorous dinosaur found to date. But in Stanley Field Hall, she looks small. I mean, the elephants, I grew up going to the Field Museum and looking at the elephants. With they stand taller than she does because they're on pedestals. So I always thought she was not displayed to her best. Not by any means. And it's a great space for a titanosaur because it's going to fill that room. So to me, it's perfect.
Yeah, the new one will be 3 times larger and 7 times bulkier. But, you know, this
and you'll be able to touch it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because it's a replica, but it'll look just like, I mean, they're all bones. You don't see the body and the muscle and the meat. But, yeah, you'll be able to touch the titanosaur.
Well, you don't even see, but then they're not even real bone. Like, of Sue, the dinosaur that you discovered, what percent of the bones that I see at the Field Museum are actual Sue bones, and what percentage of them are casts of what the other bones probably were?
It depends on how you count it by bone surface or bone numbers, but she's 85 to 90% real. Her
oh, really?
Skull, the skull that's on the skeleton is a cast. Her real skull is in a separate case.
I remember that. But, I mean, no kidding. That's quite exceptional, isn't it? Because normally when we have these dinosaurs, we get just a very small fragment of it, and the rest of it is put together. Mostly what we see of Sue is actual, huh?
Yeah, she's mostly real, and that is exceptional. There's very few dinosaurs of any species found that are relatively, or in Sue's case, almost complete. The few bones missing with her, fortunately, were mostly present on the other side. So it's she's exceptional in many ways. The largest, the most complete, the best preserved. Again, not the way you can ever imagine finding them, but there she was.
So
and she wanted to be found.
Yeah,
I think she got up the night before we're going to leave and slashed the tire on the truck. And then ran back into the rocks there, said, gosh darn it, Sue felt me. She's got to come over here. So I think that's why we got a flat tire. She really wanted to be found. She was tired of waiting for 66 million years.
So what would be the ideal next discovery then for you? Another big Tyrannosaurus, a species not yet found at all? What are you looking for?
Well, I like the look. Cretaceous, that's when T-Rex roamed, and Triceratops. I don't know. With Sue, we found bones, just individual bones of 3 other T-Rex. I think it would be awesome to find, you know, a family or a group of T-Rex. So that, I really love Triceratops, too. And, you know, and they're, I won't say they're common, but there's quite a few have been found partial, even with Triceratops, it's hard to find a whole skeleton, but you find pieces and partial skulls. I don't care. I just like to find stuff. It's an addiction discovery. When you find something, when you're the first one to see it, it's like this giant gift. And once you do that and you do it a few times, that's what I go out there for. It doesn't have to be another great specimen. I just get thrilled if it's a pretty bone, you know, or a tooth. And I'm a commercial diver by trade, and I work in marine archaeology. And I've same thing on a really great shipwreck, or I also work a lot in Egypt on the second cities there. So when you uncover something and see it, that moment when you first see something for the first time, and you know that you're the first person to have seen it for either hundreds of years or millions of years, if it's dinosaurs, there's nothing like that. And then the next moment, the second best moment, is when you show it to someone else. That kind of makes it real. Otherwise, maybe you were just imagining it all. But after that, you just want to go find something else. You know, after that comes the hard work of excavation and then the extremely long work of conservation and then ultimately exhibition and studies. And that goes on for years and years. But that's why I'm called a field paleontologist. I look for, find, and excavate things rather than the scientist who studies all the bones or other than the preparator who prepares them. And then there's another team that mounts the bones. It's a huge group that contributes to any specimen.
And my understanding is that your dinosaur Sue is going to be mounted in a different way. She's actually going to be playing beach volleyball. She's going to be up in the air with that little arm spiking. I don't know if you knew that, but that's what they're going to have.
Well, I didn't know volleyball, but yeah, hey, why not?
Yeah,
you know,
why not?
She's very alive to me.
I can
tell. But it's great because she's moving. It is the perfect opportunity to update her stance a little bit. There's been a lot of studies done on T-Rex, and a lot of it thanks to her because of her completeness. They've learned many things that weren't known before. And the gastralia, the belly ribs, she's going to look different. She's going to look heavier, fatter. She's got a big belly out in front of her. So, and it's not a beer belly. It wasn't when she was cheering on the Cubs. But she was cheering on the Cubs. But
hey, by the way, I'm going to let you go. I got to let you go. But when are you going to come back to Chicago, either for the new display or the moving of yours?
It's sometime. I haven't been there for quite a while, and I really do want to see her. And I'm totally thrilled that she's moving because I think she'll be much more accessible and much more impressive.
There you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Display. Sue Hendrickson, outraged that they're moving Sue the dinosaur to a different location.
Outraged, thrilled.
Oh, that's right, thrilled. Okay, listen, when you come to town again, let's make plans to get together. We'd love to host you in our studio as well, Sue.
Okay, sounds good.
Thanks for your time and thanks for joining us. She's in Seattle, but back from a trip overseas, we were able to reach her more easily here and catching up with her there. I've been playing. I don't have time to play it here, but Rocket Man, Elton John, coming out of the commercial set. You get it? That's kind of funny. Rocket Man.
That's right. Coming up with Rocket Man at 4:20.
This is there's a great picture that's gone viral of John Kelly, the chief of staff.
Yeah.
Who has his head in his hands during the speech as he's sitting behind
the UN speech today?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And one does wonder exactly what was the moment in which he did that.
Well, it's got to be Rocket Man, right?
You wonder. It seems that was one of the most uncharacteristic parts of the speech, for
well,
sure,
don't you get
before
the feeling,
a UN audience.
It's a speech that somebody wrote, and he read as presidentially as he could, and so props to him. He seemed to be able to handle
that.
Yeah,
it's pretty good.
But then every now and then there's these flourishes. You go, oh, yeah, it's Donald Trump, because the Rocket Man speech, the rest of the world's going to hell, mm-hmm. going to hell. As a reference in a speech like that, just
yeah,
seemed odd.
Well, I don't know that could have been vetted because someone would have explained to him that when you're speaking to an international audience like that of international diplomats, going to hell is an American colloquialism, or certainly a Western colloquialism that does not translate well.
Right.
Does not translate well in the Middle East, does not translate well in Asia, does not translate well in a lot of places.
There's times, though, where he's speaking and you think he doesn't care. Because he knows that you and I and his base understands that. They want him to stand up there and use some salty language and be not politically correct. In fact, there was some talk about the fact that he used not Islamist, but Islamic terrorists again. I don't even know what the worry about that is, but they were very concerned. And he went against his advisor's wishes on how to describe the terrorists in that speech.
Yeah,
he loves to thumb his nose at convention, especially at an event like that. What's the line that he used?
The Rocket Man is on a suicide mission.
Suicide.
I think that one raised
and
a lot.
Totally destroy. We're going to totally destroy them.
So the United Nations came out of the League of Nations, and it was designed as an instrument of peace, right? That's why they wear powder blue helmets. I mean, people make fun of the powder blue helmets, but they're powder blue for a reason. Because warriors don't wear powder blue.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. It is an instrument of peace, and to stand there in the well of the United Nations and say we're going to totally destroy someone is just not what that organization is about. You can do it. You can step outside on the steps and say it, and I get it. I mean, he's a controversial guy. His again, the base You know, conservative talk radio has always hated the United Nations. It's the sort of thing when you bring up the United Nations, you know what you're going to get: powder blue helmets and all the rest of it. But when you stop and you think about what the United Nations has done, they don't always agree with us. We do pay the lion's share, all of that. It's easy to criticize them. But where the world might be in all those places around the globe that we don't think about very often would be in terms of at least sanitation and water and the things that the UN provides. It's a big deal. He did, I give the credit, the president credit here. He did in that speech a couple of times make reference to programs that are humanitarian programs the United States is very, you know, is leading the way in. And I'm glad he did that because I'd like him to show the world that America is still, despite the attitude that he presents, is still a humanitarian nation.
Going to need some humanitarian aid in Mexico.
For sure. Can you think about it? Have you seen the video emerging from there of the buildings collapsing on the anniversary of the 1985 earthquake that had killed 5,000 people? And they were actually doing drills this morning because of that anniversary, just to earthquake preparedness.
And then here it goes.
When they get
kind of like 9/11 for us, right? Folks were doing their 9/11 drills, and then 9/11 happened. That's a story. Are you guys going to follow up on that too?
Yeah, there's a lot of this. Aaron Gutierrez is going to join us from the UN, actually, coming up. Tom Skilling's going to talk to us about Hurricane Maria. And we, in past episodes of things like this, Tom has a little a base knowledge of the kinds of effects that these kinds of geological events can have as well. And then the Paul Manafort story. Mike Monaco is going to be here. We got a top five. And then it's Hawks first.
Oh, that's right.
Yep.
Game of the
Go
season
Hawks.
On 720 WGN against the Columbus Blue Jackets.
Somebody's getting off early tonight.
I'm not doing that for that reason, John. I'm just saying.
We're very excited as Hawks fans.
You smiled. You actually smiled when you said Hawks.